This year, our podcast will explore the multi-layered experiences which encompass Ireland's past, and will also put into context how the sense of heritage is all about our collective experience, and why so much that went before still resonates in the present. I hope you enjoy the show. The prestigious Museum Standards Programme for Ireland exists to set the benchmark for achieving excellence across the Irish museum sector. Established by the Heritage Council 16 years ago, selection under the programme is seen as a major accolade. Each museum in the programme goes through a rigorous process to achieve high standards across a range of areas. These include how they care for their collections, as well as the manner in which they provide their education and exhibition programmes. In total, 47 have achieved the pinnacle of the programme, having achieved full accreditation. In today's podcast, Leslie Ann Hayden, MSPI Coordinator, and Brian Crowley, Curator of Collections in Kilmainham Jail, take us through the evolution of the programme, its importance to the sector, and what the future holds for Irish museums. Leslie Ann Hayden, a big welcome to the Heritage Council podcast. How are you keeping?
I'm keeping very well, Greg. Nice to be here this afternoon.
Oh, thank you so much. And a sunny, glorious afternoon it is.
It is, absolutely. I live near the sea, so I'm dying to go outside, but happy to talk to you.
Thank you so much. And you're the Museum Standards Programme Manager for Ireland?
Yes, I am.
And that won't mean anything to so many people. But of course, by the end of this podcast, hopefully they'll know everything about it and the vital role it plays and how we can benefit from it as Joe Public.
I hope so. My role is to facilitate museums to achieve certain standards and how they look after their collections. And I work with many museums across Ireland. And the programme has had a great effect on museums throughout Ireland, both from the perspective of bringing them more together as a sector. You've got small museums, volunteer-run museums, who could come to one of our training programmes and be sitting next to the registrar of the National Gallery. Or they could just know more locally and have the confidence. If you're a museum in Mayo, we'll give you the confidence to ring up the National Museum in Turlock Park and say, can you help us? So the programme over the last 15 or 16 years has had a great influence on how Ireland's collections are taken care of.
Of course, all of this culminates in an awards ceremony, which this year is happening on the 27th of July.
That's correct. This will be our second online ceremony. Last year's was delayed somewhat. So last year's should have had its ceremony and would normally have been at Kilkenny Castle with a lovely lunch and their colleagues coming together to celebrate them. But with the pandemic, our 2019 applicants, we were finally able to acknowledge them in February of this year. And last year, through the pandemic, we had 10 further museums in the programme submit applications for accreditation, and they are being acknowledged next week in an online ceremony as well. So I'm busy working on that at the moment.
And this is a programme that's been run by the Heritage Council, and I know the first year was 2007, so we're well into the programme at this stage, and I know you've been with it ever since that time. Why did we feel there was a need to run any accreditation around museums and galleries and collections in Ireland? What's the whole point of it and what's the motivation?
Okay, well, it really goes back a little bit further than 2007. When the Heritage Council was established in the 1990s, one of the areas over which it has authority are heritage objects. And where are heritage objects found? They're found, a lot of them are found in museums. And Ethna Verling, who is now the director of Galway City Museum, was then Museum and Archives Officer at the time. And the Heritage Council had a number of meetings with the sector in the 1990s and said to the sector itself, what do you want us to do? And out of those meetings came the response, we would like an accreditation scheme. They have an accreditation scheme in the UK. There are accreditation schemes in Europe or Canada or North America, in Australia. But in Ireland, we don't have an accreditation scheme. In fact, a lot of museums in Ireland were working in isolation, and most of the museums in Ireland are not staffed by professionals with museum studies degrees. A lot of them are volunteer run, or a lot of people come into working in the museum. And what they were looking for was a scheme that would give them the confidence to understand that they were caring for their collections, but also in liaising with other museums in the country around the world as well, that perhaps if they wanted to put on an exhibition, that a museum in the UK would have the confidence to lend them an object. And the UK are used to liaising with accredited museums, and Ireland's museums at that time were not able to say that they were accredited. Anyway, rapidly go through all of that. There was a four-year pilot study, two pilot studies, and 12 of Ireland's museums were involved in the pilot study. And from the very beginning, this was seen as a scheme for the Irish museum sector. So the museums that were chosen to participate in this ranged from cultural institutions such as the Chester Beatty Library and the National Gallery, to local authority museums such as Monaghan County Museum and Waterford Treasures, to volunteer-run museums such as Museum Cork Agrina in Ballyferriter. The Hunt Museum, as a private not-for-profit, was also run. So there was a grand mixture of museums in this mix. And what they were seeking was to develop a scheme that was fit for the Irish sector, but also could be seen as meeting international minimum standards. So, for instance, in records management, they would look at the standard there, which is a standard called Spectrum. So, where necessary, Ireland replicated the scheme, what was done in the UK's scheme. But ours, in the end, is somewhat slightly different in that in our scheme, each museum is going to be visited by assessors as they're being assessed. So as well as putting an application together, you get a site visit several times through the process. And also our scheme is very much collections focused. So for us, you could be a museum, you could be a gallery. The Irish Film Archive was recently accredited under the programme. The Old Library in Trinity College is accredited under the programme. The Edward Worth Library, which is in Dr. Stevens Hospital next to Houston Station, is working to submit an application for interim accreditation this year. Following that pilot study, the Heritage Council then agreed a set of 34 standards. They agreed a process with assessors and so on. But where I came to be engaged was there was a bit of a hiatus. It was agreed in 2004, and then the Heritage Council adopted this programme. And then I saw an advertisement in 2005, and it said, we would like to engage somebody on a contract basis for the next 2 years to coordinate the museum standard. Oh, well, it wasn't called the Museum Standards Programme then. It was called an accreditation scheme for Irish museums. And I applied for that. It said an interest in museums is not necessarily necessary. In other words, they were looking at skills with regard to organisation and management and understanding of working with people, as well as an interest in collections. And I happen to combine both. I have a degree in art history. I have volunteered in museums. I volunteered in the Badishu Museum in Canada. And anyway, I was engaged to do this. But one of the first things that I had to do was to go and visit all 12 museums in the pilot study and say to them, do you think this was worthwhile? Would you like to go on and now do accreditation for real? In other words, you've been through mock processes, you've done the mock leaving. Will you now do it for real? And all of them said, yes, we would.
Okay. And for those initial 12, what did it achieve?
For the initial 12, going through the pilot study, there was a sense of confidence that it gave them. But I think while there's a photograph of them all achieving a lovely platter for their efforts put into this, I think finally working through submitting an application for accreditation, whether for the 25 interim standards or the 34 full standards, and receiving their accreditation certificates in 2007, the first museums to achieve full accreditation with the National Gallery and three sites in Muckross, Muckross House, Muckross Traditional Farms, and the Muckross Library. And then other museums went on to achieve interim accreditation. At that stage, the programme also expanded its panel of assessors. So we had broadened the panel, and the panel of assessors includes experts in the museum world from the UK, from Northern Ireland, as well as from the Republic of Ireland. And for a lot of them, having a Northern Irish or a UK assessor come in, especially in the early years where there was a lack of confidence, and say, you are doing a good job, you have met these standards, how you look after your collections, how you understand the environment in which you are housing your collections, how you are presenting your collections, the fact that you have a strategic plan in place and understand the financial planning with regard to running your museum and can demonstrate that. All of this, I think, led to a greater professionalism and a great deal of confidence. And also then, when the Heritage Council advertised for museums to join the programme in 2006, so the next tranche started in 2007, there was a great response, and 12 museums were invited to join and work with them. Again, it was a mix of collections, some local authorities, I think the GAA Museum joined at that time. So trying to keep track of them all is quite difficult. But there was an interest from those who were without the programme who wanted to come in. And I can remember the curator of Drogheda Museum, Millmount, and they got in at the second or third time of asking. So there was a feeling, especially for a volunteer-run museum like Drogheda Museum, Millmount, that actually being part of the programme is really going to help them both understand how to look after their collections, but also to legitimise what they do as a museum, I think.
Yeah, and it also saw in some of the criteria that even risk assessment and disaster planning element of it.
Absolutely. In fact, in the development of the programme, disaster planning was a full standard. But when it actually came to the final programme, it was felt you can't wait up to 5 years being in the programme to actually write your disaster plan. So by interim accreditation, you have to have actually thought of disaster response procedures. And if in the worst case scenario, you have to evacuate your collections, where are they going to go? And also you've invited the guards and the fire services in to offer you advice, etc. So sometimes museums are a little scared of doing because they hope everything's going to be all right. But everything is done from the perspective of assisting. And by the time you finish, you have a comprehensive disaster plan as well. I've been to a number of disaster planning workshops, and what stuck with me each time the presenter might have talked about it was, if you have the plan and it's dark and it's windy and it's rainy and you're scared, you have the plan. And when you come back the next morning, you have somewhere to begin. You have your phone numbers and you can start reaching out. So we've all heard of some of the disasters that have happened for some museums over the last 10 to 15 years, but having your plan in place, you just open up the page and say, okay, where did we agree we would begin? Because you have to wait perhaps until the fire services let you back in and you go in and see and you say, all right. But now the museums who go through the programme have considered all of that well in advance.
Yeah, because a lot of this, Leslie, is in the public interest. Like, a lot of these items and artefacts are of huge public interest.
Yes, indeed. And you're not doing it from a PR perspective, but there are state collections, obviously, in the programme. But also, if you are a member of the general public and you have decided that you wish to donate an object or a collection to a museum, this is one of the areas where the curator of the collection can give you at least a guarantee, some sort of guarantee that this is a place where you can have a sense that this is a good place to give your items, that it will be cared for to the best possible way that the museum can, that it's a well-run organization.
Yeah, so the Museum Standards Programme really is setting a high bar.
Yeah.
But you do more than just give out certificates at the end of every year. You actually bring people through a process whereby they can be presented these awards, because there's training and everything that goes into this programme, isn't there?
That's right. The museums who enter the programme, they go through an eligibility process. In other words, you have to meet the international definition of a museum. The Heritage Council has a definition of a museum, but it's based on the ICOM, the International Committee of Museums definition of a museum. So essentially, your organization has to be not-for-profit. The collections have to be held in trust. They have to be available for the general benefit of the public, research purposes. Ultimately, there's about 9 points, but the last point is that they're a place where people can come in and have fun. So the museums apply for eligibility. They have an original collection. Their constitution allows them to meet the definition of a museum. In other words, they are not for profit and the collections are held in trust. Then when they've got through that hurdle with three criteria, they then start what can be a 3 to 5 year process to work towards meeting the 34 standards. So in year one, I organized first assessments with the assessor panels, and the assessors go in to benchmark the standards, and the applicants essentially do the mock leaving. They're given the application form and they're told, please complete this. And I oversee it with them and I go out and visit them and I say, well, if you don't do this, just say we don't do it, but please try and give as good an accounting for yourself as possible so the assessors have as much information. And by the end of year one, the applicants have a sense of which standards they're meeting or part meeting or not meeting. And then I work with them and they put together an accreditation plan, and they go on then to decide, are we going to apply for all 34 standards by year three, or are we going to go the route of the 25 interim standards by year three, and then we'll go on in a year or two's time to complete the process.
And the net result is better museums.
Well, there are museums out there that are always an interesting visit, but I suppose not. It's museums that have more confidence that what they're doing is based on good museum practice. There are always interesting objects in museums, and not all museums might have the capacity to go through it. So you can find interesting museums everywhere. So better managed museums.
Yeah, and more protection of these valuable assets
More protection of these valuable assets, or an understanding of how to protect them, or an understanding. So for instance, a lot of the museums won't have a lot of money, but they will be advised that you need to install some environmental monitoring equipment. Now, the most expensive in the world could be thousands, but you can get handheld instruments to go around and get some training to work out the heat, the light, the relative humidity, etc., and start recording them. But you still might not be able to afford that. So the Heritage Council's grant scheme also offers an opportunity to apply for a grant to purchase equipment and to perhaps get a conservator to come to train you on how to use it properly.
Yeah, so every year since 2007, more and more museums and galleries and collections have participated in the program. The bar is getting higher the whole time.
Yes.
Yeah. And as well as that, Leslie, my understanding is that this program, in a funny way, probably wasn't the intention day one, but there's like a little networking group of like-minded people. And now there's kind of soft benefits to all of this as well, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We didn't realize when we started this that we were actually what was coming out of it. And in many ways, when perhaps we did a survey of the program, it was this network, it was this contact that was being made between museums in Ireland, some of which might feel very isolated in what they did, even within their own counties. They may not have had the confidence to reach out to other museums in their counties, and not all of Ireland's counties have local authority museums. There are 12 local authority museums in the country, and there are more counties than 12. So what we found was the program is both training and accreditation. So there's an understanding, or there was an understanding from the pilot study, that Ireland's museums, while a lot of them, the larger ones, may be able to afford to go for training or to send their people on training courses, a lot of the smaller museums or the mid-sized museums, the budget for actually sending somebody on training would be a large part of their annual budget, which may not be very big. There are some museums, smaller museums out there, that might have €5,000 through the door, volunteer-run museums and so on. So there was a training program was piloted as well to support understanding what's involved in meeting the standards. And so about 6 or 7 workshops are organized every year based on the needs of the program. It's not a course per se, but you'd start off with the basics. So you'd have a course on writing collection policies and disposal policies, or a course on writing a strategic plan or collections management, or writing text for museum panels that's interesting, or customer service. In the early days, we had some workshops on customer service. And so those who were coming to these workshops were meeting their colleagues from across the board, from all over Ireland. We generally held them either in Dublin or in the Heritage Council's office in Kilkenny. On occasion, we would go out and hold a session in a museum. In fact, in the last couple of 3 years, Monaghan County Museum, the sort of members of the Museum Standards Programme headed to Monaghan. And in fact, a lot of us were on a bus coming from Dublin, and I knew where the museum was. So we were all trotting around to the museum for a wonderful workshop on diversity in museums. So through these workshops, and the Heritage Council always gives you lunch. And I've always said, even after 2008 and after the cutbacks, I said, are we going to have to lose lunch? I said, it's probably the most important part. And if we have a lunch, even if it's just soup and sandwiches or something like that, it means we keep everybody together rather than dispersing outside to find somewhere else and going off with this person that they know. So you could find yourself at lunch sitting down with somebody from a local authority museum or a cultural institution or a small volunteer run museum, etc. So everybody was being mixed together. But also I would make sure through the mentoring program as well that you met other people who were your peers with similar type of collections who'd gone through the program. So, for instance, the Edward Worth Library, I matched with Muckross House and the library. They were a bit far away, but there was a match made there. And they also know that they can talk to Susie Bialetti, the keeper of the old library in Trinity. But coming out of this, we suddenly realised, On a couple of occasions, we didn't hold lunch. And when we got the evaluation back, sort of, oh, yes, lovely, the training was great. But it's a venue. We miss lunch. We miss sitting down with everybody. But it was building that network. And then we brought the museums all together from time to time. And the program was reviewed in about 2012, 2013. And again, we brought all of the people, as many people in the programme together, representatives from each museum. And we really found that the sector was now seeing one another, that they knew one another from being in the programme. So if you were in Kerry Reiter's Museum in Nestole and you joined the programme, you got an introduction to Helen O'Carroll, who's the curator of Kerry County Museum. You got an introduction to Patricia O'Hare at Muckross. You got an introduction to Isabel Bennett at Museum Corcogreena, and so on around the country. Or if somebody rung me up and said, help, can I help? Who can help me with my records management? I would say, well, there's a very good guy in Monaghan County Museum. Or why don't you go and talk to Barry at Foyne's Flying Boat Museum? He's a librarian by background, but this records management end of things he's very good at. And just go and have a chat, because there is only me on the programme, 6 or 7 workshops. So to get the standards, we really needed that peer-to-peer training and that network that has evolved. Really, while it wasn't the intention, I think has helped the success of the programme. And I think during the pandemic now, we're all missing, not meeting one another. We are putting on online training and we see one another through the training. And I always encourage people through the chat or what have you to say hi to so-and-so as you're going through. And even next week with the award ceremony, I'll be telling everybody, oh, say hi to all of the people who are getting awards and so on. But it is a much closer sector now, I think.
And while you're the project manager, Leslie, it sounds to me like it's the participants as much as anyone is helping to bring the standards up and make this a better experience for every Irish person and every visitor to Ireland to enjoy. And on the topic of pandemics and staycations and everything, has it turned everything upside down? It probably has it?
Well, it did turn everything upside down. I mean, as we all know, from March last year, everybody was told to close their doors, and that included museums. And some of the museum personnel were allowed to go in and out of their museums during that time. And there would be key things that had to be done, like checking on the collections and so on. But I know some museums, their personnel weren't allowed into their museums for a long time. And then, of course, everybody reopened in the summer, but it was under COVID restrictions. And of course, a lot of people were frightened to go into museums. Or I know I myself, the moment the museums opened, I made a beeline to see the gold collection in Kildare Street. Now, Kildare Street is part of the programme. I could have gone to see the gold collection any time. But I think over the years, it was a sense of, oh, I know, it's still there. It's sort of, I don't have to go today. But one of the first visits I made was just to make sure that the Ardagh chalice was there and the Brota collar and all of the rest of it, and just say, because I wasn't allowed to visit, I'm now allowed to go and visit again. And then with my art history, the National Gallery is obviously a favourite of mine, sort of just across the road from Trinity, where I did my degree. And again, just being allowed to go back in. But it's the experience of just being in. And yes, you couldn't, especially last summer, you couldn't eat. But more recently, I was up at the Chester Beatty Library. And apart from visiting a lovely exhibition of Japanese prints, there's plenty of space outside the Chester Beatty. So sitting outside, just having lunch at the Silk Road Cafe, even if it's in a takeaway box, but it was in the sunshine. So that experience. So those are the positives. And I've spoken, I suppose, of the larger museums. But there are some museums out there, Greg, that are considering opening in August. They still haven't opened. Other museums haven't been able to open yet because of the amount of space they have, so to protect their visitors from COVID. But that's not to say that while they were closed, they weren't doing anything. They were working from home. I have the immediate evidence that we've got 10 museums next week that have accreditation certificates being awarded to them. And they were working through the pandemic from home on their applications and going in and out of their museums and putting their applications together from the pandemic and submitting applications in June and September of last year. Normally with our assessors, they would go on site. So I would be flying people in and putting them in hotels from the UK or Northern Ireland, or even sort of coming from around Ireland for assessments. And that couldn't be done, obviously, but we found a way to do it through Zoom and videos and photographs and so on. So the museums themselves had adapted, but I think they were ready to adapt by then, because a lot of museums, as you're probably aware, have started to digitize their collections and to show them online. But through this, a lot of museums, as with many other fields, really rapidly, we all started getting better with tech. I hadn't done Zoom until Gina O'Kelly, who is the director of the Irish Museums Association, gave me a lesson in Zoom so I could join an Irish Museums Association meeting. I'm a member of the board of directors. But from there, about 2 months later, I was teaching somebody how to use Zoom and so on. So we all learned. But the museums, their education services, they were going online. So last summer, when children were on their holidays, rather than go to the museums were putting on programs for them, art programs or drawing programs. And then the museums were putting on lecture series online. I'm a member of the Bronte. I'm a big Bronte fan, and I'm a member of the Bronte Museum in Yorkshire. And I was tuning into some lectures from Yorkshire or wherever the lecturer was in the UK and so on. So a lot of museums have adapted to that. And I don't know if you've actually done virtual tours of exhibitions, but they're sort of the standard of the virtual tours, even through the year, has so much improved. So what's coming out of this and what you're seeing now in writings about museums is hybrid education. In other words, museums may be running education programs continuing online, but also obviously their main work in the museum. But I don't think the online is going to disappear, because that has allowed them to reach out and work with larger audiences than they may have had, and audiences from much further afield, if not other countries in the world.
And from bad, you know, something good always happens, and we have
something
to
always good always happens, yes.
And adapt. So my last question for you is about the awards on the 27th of July. Is there anything special about the awards this year from your point of view?
Well, I think what's really special, and I've touched on this already, is that these museums continued to want to achieve accreditation in the programme. There are 10, we had 10 applicants last year, which is about a good, which is a good average. I mean, there's 60 museums in the programme. So we had 4 applicants for full accreditation and 6 applicants for maintenance of accreditation. And at the beginning of the pandemic, they might have said, oh God, we can't do this. We've got sort of, but they kept their focus. And in many ways, this is awful to say, having time to sit at their desk and work on their policies and their applications was probably a help. But they were focused on wanting to, for those who'd got full accreditation, and some of them had been in the programme quite a while, a little bit longer than normal, but they just wanted to complete the programme. And next week we have receiving full accreditation, a national cultural institution, the Crawford Art Gallery. We've got a volunteer-run museum, the Thomas McDonough Museum in Clochjordan. We have the Museum of Free Derry. We have one museum in the programme that is based in Northern Ireland. The Museum of Free Derry is also, though, working for its sins to achieve accreditation under the UK scheme as well. And the final museum getting accreditation is Kilkenny Castle, which is an OPW property. So it's special in its own right that they continued and they have finally completed the programme. And achieving maintenance of accreditation next week, adding to Kilkenny Castle, we have 3 further Office of Public Works properties. We have Rathfarnham Castle, Dublin Castle State Apartments and Farm Lee. We also have the GAA Museum. We also have Galway City Museum, which is a local authority museum. And we also finally have an art gallery, High Lanes Gallery, based in Drogheda. So the fact that they continued on and submitted their applications, I think shows faith in the programme, but also that the programme has meaning to them and their stakeholders. And so they have gone on and they're looking, while we'd all love them to be in Kilkenny next week to receive their awards in person, and we'd all love to be celebrating with them for lunch. At this stage, by next year's awards ceremony, there are those who are receiving next year's awards for lunch, those who are receiving next week's awards for lunch, and those who received their awards last February also have to be given their lunch. There's a certificate and lunch comes out of gaining accreditation in the programme. At least that's a first level tangible benefit, but there are so many unseen benefits to being in the programme.
And well, the awards are very important. They won't mean a whole pile to the general public.
No.
But I think as, you know, lockdown restrictions are being eased and we get to enjoy all our museums and possibly a lot of the museums we haven't even dreamt of going into. And now as we're in this kind of staycation mode, we're going through those doors. And I think a big thank you to you for being part of this program that's been run by the Heritage Council and raising those standards so that as us, we can enjoy these museums at a higher level without having to know everything that's going on in the background.
No.
So Leslie, thank you so much for coming on the Heritage Council podcast. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much. And if anybody's listening, please go and support your local museum.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Greg.
Next, we hear from Brian Crowley, curator of collections in Kilmainham Jail, who's participated in the programme and who has first-hand experience of the benefits. Brian Crowley, a big welcome to the Heritage Council podcast. How are you keeping?
I'm good. I'm good. It's a sunny day, so I'm good.
I know, and the more of those we have, the merrier.
Yeah. And if you work in a 19th century jail building, it's particularly nice because it's nice and cool inside.
Well, I think you should advertise that fact. You might get some extra punters in there today, possibly. Are you allowed to take visitors at the moment?
Not at the moment. We're hoping soon. But yeah, there's kind of additional restrictions on museums that allow access by guided tour. So unfortunately, unlike some of our other colleagues, the jail hasn't been able to open yet. But we're hoping soon.
Okay, very good. We've already heard from Leslie and Hayden, the programme manager for the Museum Standards Programme for Ireland. And I know you've been involved in that programme in different guises. Your role, Brian, could you tell the listener what your role, plural, I think, your roles?
So I am the curator of collections for the Pearse Museum and Kilmainham Jail Museum. So I suppose basically I'm responsible for the historic collections there. And that would also include, I suppose, exhibitions and allowing access as well to members of the public and researchers who might have queries about the collection. So it's basically kind of taking care of it and also, I suppose, developing it and dealing with donations and that kind of thing.
Okay. And you've been in the business for more than a year or two, I think. You're celebrating 25 years this year.
Yeah, it's 25 years since I first got a job in a museum, and kind of slightly disturbingly, the museum was actually Kilmainham Jail. My first job was as a guide here back in 1996. So though slightly muted celebrations this year, obviously, because we weren't open to the public, but it's probably a year to take a little bit of stock on what I've been doing with myself for the last quarter century.
And was that a huge interest in the area, or was it just a summer job?
Yeah, it was just a summer job. That was, and this area of kind of Irish history wasn't something that I had a particular interest in. I'd actually studied 16th century Irish history, had been my speciality when I was doing my undergrad, which is a period characterized by the lack of material culture it produced. So not great for museums. But no, I just was kind of very taken with the idea of museums and objects and how objects can help you understand the past and also kind of complicate the past as well and offer a different perspective on history. And I suppose the thing that appealed to me most was the fact that it was a way of, I suppose, engaging with the past, but also engaging with people, because it's a very kind of, I suppose, a very public focused role that we do. It's very much, I suppose, kind of public history. And that was something that I was kind of particularly taken with.
And as a tour guide, obviously you're up close and personal and experiencing how people interact with our history. Did you learn a lot from that tour guide experience, you know, about how we interpret things?
Oh, definitely. I think it was probably one of the most useful things I've ever done in terms of the rest of my career, because essentially what you're doing as a tour guide is you're trying to kind of convey a story to people, and you're doing that using, I suppose, an object, and in the case of Kilmainham and most other sites, it's a building, but you're trying to explain the past through, I suppose, through material culture. And I think that everybody who is ever going to be involved in exhibitions or interpretation should have a season working as a tour guide, because it teaches you so much about how to communicate with people and how to focus on not so much on what you're saying, but what they're hearing as well, because that was something that became very clear to me. What I thought I was saying and what they were hearing was, we're not always the same thing. And I suppose just to kind of get a sense as well as like how people engage with the past and how important it can be for people as well. And I suppose the other reason I tell everybody to do that, they should be a tour guide for a while, is just in terms of public speaking and stuff like that. And as I said, just engaging with large groups of people. After a while doing guided tours, it's not something that scares you very much anymore. It's just, you know, it's 3 o'clock, 50 Spanish students who want to be shown around, and, you know, you just have to get on with it. But as I said, that was something that always really interested me, was that how do we communicate this story? Because to a certain extent, I think museums sometimes in the past, where people were very kind of specialized on they were very interested in their subject matter, but they weren't necessarily skilled in how to share that enthusiasm with other people. And as I said, one thing you learn very quickly as a tour guide is how to do that.
Yeah. And if you don't get that right, you're missing a big opportunity, aren't you?
Yeah. Like, you know, you can have the most wonderful thing in the world, but unless you find a way of telling its story and communicating that story with people, to a certain extent, what's the point? And particularly in Kilmainham, where so many of the most remarkable objects in the collection are objects that on the face of it look very ordinary. So like one of my favorite objects is a box of chocolates that was given to Thomas Whelan, who was awaiting execution during the War of Independence in Mountjoy. And he was given that box of chocolates by one of the British soldiers who was guarding him. And then he gave it to the daughter of his landlady, where he lived in Dublin on Barrow Street. And he said to her, if I'm released, we'll eat these together. If I'm executed, just go ahead and eat them yourself. And she never opened the box. So the box is there and it's the chocolates are inside and they've desiccated and you can hear them. If you move it, they rattle. But on the outside, it's just a box. It's just an old box of chocolates and just kind of weird, strange survival from the past. But in that object, there's so many things happening in terms of the personal story of him, how his friends and family, that kind of grief that they felt. But also I'm really interested in the fact that he has this kind of warm personal relationship with somebody who on paper is his, I suppose, his enemy. But as I said, our job is to try and communicate why this object is this kind of repository for memory and stories. So as I said, you know, with the Kilmainham collection in particular, so many of the objects on the outside just look like nothing. And then you dig deeper and you realize that they're actually kind of profound and poetic objects.
And there's that storytelling element of it, but there's also the role of the museums in Ireland as tourist attractions and in a staycation world and everything. Mm. I actually noticed in the list of participants, I'm living in Cork, so I saw Nanonagel Place getting a special mention as one of the participants. And I was chatting to one of the voluntary tour guides there, a lovely man, it's a retired guy, Bernard Bossinet is his name. And he was saying he loves being a tour guide. But exactly what you're saying is that depending on the audience that he has on the particular day, he chooses himself different things to connect that audience. He said if he has some children in the group, he focuses on something else. And maybe that's the difference between having, you know, something pre-programmed, you know, you press play and it gives you a standard story, and having a live tour guide who's flexing the whole time. Because I'm sure the script that you were given day one, 25 years ago, what you were saying to people after a few months was probably quite different.
Oh, yeah. No, definitely. There was no script.
Oh dear.
We went on other people's tours. And yeah, so no, it very much kind of evolved. And in some ways, I remember sometimes I think there were aspects of it where as I got more enthusiastic about the history, there were aspects of my tour probably that got a little bit worse because I was probably talking too much. And then after a while of, you know, you start to sense what is engaging people and what isn't. But yeah, you start to learn as well to adapt to the audience that you have. And that's, again, one of the key to being really good at it. And I worked with I had a colleague and she was the best tour guide I ever worked with. But her ability just to read the group and what they were interested in and engage them was remarkable. And to see what people are kind of connecting with, because people are very, very different and they need different, really different approaches. Actually, one of the last in-person training things I did, we did some autism awareness training with As I Am just before lockdown. And again, it was really interesting just to see how autistic people might require something different from us on the tour in terms of the things that they might want to engage with. But even then, within autism, it's such a literally a spectrum that, you know, again, there's no one size fits all. So I think one of the things that you are aware of as a tour guide and what I hope we bring through into the museum is that different things are going to appeal to different people. And that, as I said, there's no cookie cutter approach to how people engage with stories as individual as people in many ways.
And that early experience that you had, I think that set you on a path then of education, didn't it? Did you went to the UK to do some specific courses?
Yeah, so I went to do an MA in museology in the University of East Anglia. And then my first job after that was with Tyne and Wear Museums in the northeast of England. So I was based in Newcastle upon Tyne, but Tyne and Wear encompassed kind of Sunderland, North and South Shields and Gateshead. So it was this big area. And it was it was a great project. It was a Millennium Project. So we got 200 people to more or less donate 5 objects about their lives. And it was very much looking at people who were underrepresented in museum collections. I remember the first thing they asked me to do is say, can you see who's donating to our museums? Like, who are they and who's not donating to the museum? And I basically said, mostly everyone is not donating to the museum. It was amazing when you started to look at stuff about where material was coming from. Museum workers were very much overrepresented in terms of, like, because they used to do a lot of contemporary collecting, but it was all being done by curators themselves, you know, and I did some myself while I was there. So it was about kind of saying, what would people pick? You know, what are the objects that are important to people? And what was really interesting is often these objects were not things that we would even thought of collecting. And again, what was so interesting was that certain objects were utterly transformed by the story that we got from the person about why this object. So at the end of that experience, one of the things I realized was that museums traditionally have been very good about recording what things are, but not what they mean. And what do they mean? And what's the emotional connection that people have with material culture? And when I was doing that project, I remember I met really amazing people. And I met this woman who would have been in her 70s at the time. And she was, I'd done an oral history interview with her, and it was amazing. And she had an amazing kind of soul. And then she contacted me to say, oh, I've chosen my object. And it was an iron. And I was kind of going, an iron, this, you know, you're an amazing person. I don't know if this is as amazing as you are. But anyway, we did an interview together, and I talked to her about her life. And then I asked her about this iron. So she was a dressmaker, and she described how when she'd been married, she had a very loving marriage. They had no children. They're incredibly close. And then he died, and she was absolutely bereft. And she said he had just got a new suit. So she said, I got his suit and I picked it apart, because she said, I was so angry and I just wanted to destroy something. And then I made a new suit for myself out of his suit. And this, it was actually a tailoring iron that she had donated to us. And I was going, this is the most, like, amazingly profound, beautiful object. And yet, as I said, on the face of it, it was just an iron. You know, that was such a useful and amazing project to be part of. And I remember at the time as well, realizing that because I was Irish and I was working in the UK, it was a huge advantage, because A, I didn't know anything. Or I wasn't expected to know anything. So I could just kind of say, explain what this is. And also, I suppose I was, you know, there was no issues around class or region or whatever. So I could kind of flow through society without having to worry about all these other things. And, you know, and sometimes it sounds weird thing to say about in terms of museums, but sometimes a bit of ignorance is great. Sometimes not knowing too much about a subject can result in you doing a better exhibition, because in a way you don't get kind of caught up. The more you know about something, sometimes the more you want to try and kind of squeeze it all in. So sometimes I feel the best exhibitions that I've done museum writing for are ones where I've not necessarily been the expert, but have the perspective of somebody who is trying to find out more about a subject.
If you get it right, Brian, you communicate and it achieves that purpose, and that story leaves the museum or the gallery or the collection with that person, and it travels and it travels. If you get it wrong, it's just an object in a case or whatever. So you've been in the industry a while, and I know that Leslie Ann asked you to do a pep talk to the groups that come in and participate in the program. Why has she chosen you, and what do you tell the group?
I don't know, but probably because I talk too much. But I suppose one of the things I try to tell people is, initially when you're looking at the program, like, and it is a big exercise, it's a lot of work for the museum. But one of the illustrations I use is, you know, that story, that cliche about the elephant, like, how do you eat an elephant one bite at a time? So one of the things I kind of say to them is, don't panic, and, you know, breathe. It's a process. It's not a, you know, it's a marathon. It's not a sprint. And in some ways, it's just about doing little bits consistently, and slowly but surely you kind of get to the end of the process. And sometimes some people can do it quicker and some people can need more time, but the focus shouldn't be on getting stuff over the line within a particular period, but it's actually about making the changes that are necessary in your museum. So yeah, so mostly I tell them not to panic, and also that it's very doable. And also it's a program that encompasses everyone from like the National Museum with hundreds of staff and millions of objects to, you know, a small volunteer museum in Mayo. So like there's all kinds of museums, and it's a program which is designed to adapt to the capacity of different museums and institutions. And it's very much kind of rooted within the sector. So it's very much a program that has grown out of the sector as well. So obviously like the Heritage Council has led it, but the sector has very much kind of bought into it and has been part of how it has developed over the years. And then the other thing I just kind of say is it's not a test. It's not the Leaving Cert. You know, and the assessors aren't there to catch you out. They're there to help and support you. And they're people who've worked in museums. So if you're going to come to them and say, listen, we have a leaky roof, we're trying to fix the leaky roof, they know that they're not expecting you to, you know, be up there on the roof yourself, fixing the hole. They realize that it's not, you know, things don't happen overnight. And that what they're really looking for is that you have a plan, that you know sometimes what the problems are, but you're working to address them. So like when we did the application for Kilmainham, there was an issue around some material that was kind of being stored elsewhere. And this week I actually rang up when I was talking to Leslie Ann, I just said, by the way, you know, when we made our application, we said, we know this is a problem, we're looking to address it. And I said, the last stuff is being delivered today. So, you know, and like, you know, we still got maintenance, whatever, because, you know, we had a plan in place and we were kind of following through on it.
I think you were explaining to me before we hit record that it gives you that standard. It takes opinions out of it. It gives everyone a route map that's based on good, solid principles. And that's everything from choosing what to go in the collection, how to document everything, how to protect these valuable pieces of our history to make sure they're not going to get caught up in a storm or a leaky roof or any of those things, the kind of risk management and everything else.
One of the most difficult things sometimes I've had to do in my job is where somebody has come to me with something that is very important and very precious to them. And it is, you know, is something that is very important and valuable. And they want to donate it to the museum. And then I'm in the position of saying, well, actually, this isn't the kind of material that we donate, that there's no point in you giving this to us because, you know, we won't have a place to ever put it on display, or it won't be, you know, like if a researcher is interested in this object, they're not going to come to us because they won't expect us to have it. And as part of MSPI, one of the things you have to do is have a collections policy where you decide very deliberately and really put a lot of time into considering what is it that you collect, and why you collect what you do. So it's much easier in a way where I'm saying it's not me making this decision, and also that I'm not saying no on a whim, that we have thought about that. And similar, you know, if people want to borrow material from us, that we have a loan policy now. And again, it's not based on the whim of me, but actually it's something that we have thought about and that we've put a lot of thought into over the years. So yeah, it makes it, I suppose, less personal, but also I think it's easier if people realize that, you know, this is something that has been considered and worked through. And it makes you, as a person working in the museum, more confident in your decisions as well. So you're not second guessing yourself because you know that you've put the work in.
Yeah, and there is a big A to Z of different types of museums, as you were saying, and maybe not everyone would have got the benefit of, you know, an education per se in the sector, and it helps everyone to come up with that standard. So you've been involved for 25 years at a time when we didn't have the Museum Standards Programme. And obviously so many years on and so many participants and everything. Can you see the difference beyond Kilmaine and the Pearse Museum, you know, with some of your colleagues? Can you see the industry evolving as a result?
Oh, most definitely. Because as well as my involvement in terms of my day job, I've been very involved in the sector. So I was on the board of the Irish Museums Association for many years. And I was chair of the board for a number of years. And particularly, I think, in terms of smaller museums, and, you know, I would actually count Kilmaine and the Pearse Museum among that. It really has been transformational in terms of how we go about our work, the level of just professionalism that you see when you go to museums. But, you know, sometimes professionalism sounds very kind of quite a cold word, but actually it's about effective communication and engagement with the public. And one of the things that the Museum Standards Programme does is it gives you kind of a structure to support you. And it's very much, it's a programme really at its core, it's about kind of supporting the work of museums. And because you have that structure, you're able to build upon it. So in some ways, because you have all these other kind of often very practical day-to-day things, you have a system in place, then you have the space to be a bit more imaginative and a bit more engaged. So there's all kinds of other projects and developments within the Irish museum sector that I think inadvertently owe existence to MSPI because it's given this kind of foundation for people. So it really, as I said, it really has been transformational. And also, you know, even the fact, and I suppose we're more conscious of it now because of lockdown, you know, being brought together with people on training courses or just because we've all been through the same experience in terms of making our application, and there's kind of a mentorship. So I think it was Liam Bradley in Monaghan Museum was my mentor for the Pearse Museum. And I've done, you know, I've been done something similar for the Maritime Museum and for the College of Physicians. And those relationships have been very useful and very important. And even other colleagues as well, like a lot of Office of Public Works museums. So we're part of the Office of Public Works in Kilmaine and Pearse. A lot of our properties, our collections have gone for MSPI as well. And we have a lot of, you know, shared experiences that we can kind of learn from each other. So it's brought us much closer together. And as a sector, I think it's really kind of created both kind of professional partnerships, but also kind of personal connections. So it's much easier to ring somebody up for advice or to apply for a loan if you've already met them at a training course about disaster planning or whatever. So I think it has really helped in terms of creating a sense of community in the sector, which is, again, I think probably not something that when they were originally devising the project that they thought would be one of the outcomes. But for me, it's one of the really important ones.
Yeah, it's funny in the conversation that I had with Leslie Ann, she was very animated about the lunch. And when you get together, we have to have the lunch. And of course, immediately you think, oh my God, that's all about overhead and everything. She said, I don't care. It's a soup and sandwiches. It doesn't matter. We have to have the lunch. And what she was talking about really was your group, you know, when you're not listening to a presentation or whatever, but sitting around, breaking bread together, learning from each other, and that bit of networking and the peer learning. So in some respects, Brian, is the peer learning nearly as important as the formal learning?
I think so. I think, like, you know, just knowing I can pick up the phone and I can ask somebody about something, or I heard them talking about that they had done something in the past, just knowing that really helps. And like, certainly, I suppose the OPW is very particular because there were so many of us doing it. But like, one of the things when I'm doing that introduction for Leslie Ann as well is I say, again, it's not an exam. So you don't necessarily always have to start from the beginning. So if somebody else has a loans policy, look what their loans policy is. And if they're the same kind of museum, you could maybe just, you know, not exactly cut and paste, but, you know, feel free to plagiarize as much as possible. Because certainly, again, and this is maybe just a particularly important in terms of the OPW, but, you know, because we now have very similar policies about things like loans and actually disaster plans as well, we have very similar disaster plans in terms of how they're structured. That's actually a real positive, because everybody kind of is literally singing from the same hymn sheet on different matters. And I said, you really can just kind of learn so much. And sometimes it's, you know, museum work can actually be very isolated because a lot of museums, they might be the only museum in their area. In some cases, you know, nearly the only one in the county. So you don't necessarily get to meet many other people who do what you do, you know. So like if you work in a county museum, most of the people you're working with work for the county council and they're looking after roads and public services and stuff like that. So it can be really useful just to talk to somebody who's doing the same thing that you're doing. And also sometimes it's really, there's kind of certain nerdy aspects to what we do that we get quite enthusiastic about. I can't really go home to my other half and say, wait till I tell you about this new object category that we came in up with today. Or, you know, I find a whole new way of packing objects in the storeroom. So it's really good to talk to other people who find that interesting.
So on the subject of holidays and the time that's in it and the opening up of things, and if you were to go on a busman's holiday, do you have a few museums around the country that you've planned on visiting?
In terms of museums that I have like kind of a particular affection for, and actually I've been thinking about it this week because Sabine O'Donoghue, who's the curator up in Cavan County Museum, is retiring. And back in 2016, I did a talk at a seminar about how we had commemorated the rising or how different museums had commemorated it and kind of contrasting it with like the 66 when there was only really one museum really looking at it. So I went up to Cavan there. What I like about that museum in particular is just how imaginative it is. So for the anniversary of the First World War, they created a recreation of the trenches, but it's in Cavan. But there's something really profound because you're in this space and you're thinking about these men from Cavan who went to France to fight in the war, and yet you're also rooted in the landscape and Cavan life is happening all around you. You can see a farmer on the hill across farming and you're thinking about, you know, he's the same type of person who might have gone to France. Then in 2016, I heard a rumor that Sabina was going to build a GPO in the garden of the museum. And I thought, that sounds like a terrible idea. And then I went and it was one of the most profound meditations on 1916 and what it was like just to be a person. Because what it became was an exhibition about the choices that people made and why they might have made those particular choices. So that's definitely somewhere I want to visit. Also hoping we had a holiday cancel last year. We were going to go up to the north, actually. So I want to go to Mount Stuart because never been. And then, I do like a good, as I said, I do like a good kind of county museum. But also, you know, there's also kind of certain kind of quirky museums as well. I think one of the most engaging museums in Dublin is the Hurdy Gurdy Museum.
Okay, I haven't even heard of that one.
So it's up in Holt, and it's based in a Martello Tower, and it's a museum of radios and communication. And it's just filled with stuff. But what makes it are the people who work there, because I know nothing about technology, but they manage to kind of communicate so effectively their enthusiasm and, you know, why these things are important. But also, like you were mentioning the Nanonagel place, and I haven't been to see it yet, and I really want to see it. And it was one of the things I was going to do before lockdown. I said, I'm just going to go down someday to Cork because I wanted to go there, and I wanted to go out to Spike Island because I'm a bit of a prison history nerd as well. So just so many places at the moment I'd love to be. But as I said, a bit of a busman's holidays. The other thing I think people who work in museums have to realize is that while we might have a good stamina for going to lots and lots of museums, sometimes our other half doesn't. So it was an important moment in our relationship where I was told, well, you do that. You go and see the museum and I'm going for a beer and I'll see you afterwards. So, there's that issue as well.
Brian, enjoy the rest of the summer and thank you so much for coming on the Heritage Council podcast. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Greg.
Yeah, good man yourself.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to the Heritage Council podcast. For more information about our projects and programs, our work with others and our publications, please check our website, heritagecouncil.ie. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram or LinkedIn, or subscribe to our YouTube channel. See you again soon.